You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 57 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Remember, you can connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or swing by our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. We just had an election in Sweden on the 9th of September. So this episode is going to be all about breaking down that election and talking about the role that social media played within it. My guest today is Dr. Anna Maria Ducek-Segesten, who's been on the pod a few times. She is a senior lecturer in European Studies and vice chair at the Center for European Studies at Lund University in Sweden. She's an expert on Swedish politics and social media, so she is the perfect person to help us break down exactly what happened in this election. And just as a bit of prefacing, the election results came in where you have a coalition of parties on the center left and a coalition of parties on the center right. With 99% of the votes counted, about 40% of the vote went to each of those blocks. And the big story that's been all over the media is the Sweden Democrats, who are a immigration critical party, typically associated with the far right, but also have social policies that lean towards the far left, getting about 17% of the vote. And this creates a situation of political uncertainty in Sweden where we don't know exactly how the government is going to work this out, how a coalition will be formed. So very exciting stuff. I'm going to go ahead and cut straight to the interview. There is a live stream version up on the Social Media and Politics podcast Facebook page where we took a few live questions as well. So without further ado, let me bring on Dr. Ducek-Segesten. Again, she is a senior lecturer in European Studies and vice chair at the Center for European Studies at Lund University. Dr. Ducek-Segesten, thanks so much for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics podcast.
Always a pleasure.
So here we are on the morning after the Swedish elections, and there hasn't been too much time to process the results yet, but you've been covering these elections extensively. And so before we dive into the issues and campaigning around the election, I'd like to get your take on the big question, which is, what are the biggest takeaways from the election results? What matters and what doesn't?
What matters? This is the million-dollar question. I think there are a couple of takeaways. I'll start maybe with that which all the international media has been focusing on, namely the success of the far-right party, the Sweden Democrats, which indeed is a success. They have registered a growth with 4.5 or 4.7% compared to the 2014 results. But this result is, while very good, not as good as expected or projected by the different opinion polls done before the election. And the atmosphere at the party headquarters, or the party headquarters yesterday night, was full of glee, but with a shadow of regret. The projections were as high as 25% in some of the opinion polls. So 17.7 is not really as much as they thought. However, this is definitely a very significant result of the elections, and it simply means that the traditional political balance between the left and the right in Swedish politics is no longer manageable. And this is probably the largest and most significant consequence of the elections as a whole. The presence of a strong niche party, a non-aligned party, strongly affects the possibility of forming a strong government, and the negotiations for forming such a government are going to be extremely difficult, more difficult than normal.
Right. And I want to talk about that government formation and coalition building in a second. But I mean, we've got to talk about the Sweden Democrats. Who are they? And I mean, in the same way Donald Trump dominates the media sphere in the U.S., the Sweden Democrats play a similar role in Sweden. They've been a big part of the reason the election has been in focus internationally as well. So we open up ourselves to all type of criticism talking about this party, you know, trolls and the online army that they have, which I want to ask you about in a second. But there are understandably some concerns about refugee influxes and immigration in Sweden. So my question is, who are the Sweden Democrats? What is the reason that they're so popular in international press? And can you kind of put their rise in the larger development of immigration in Sweden since the 1970s?
This is a very long question, and we could spend the entire podcast talking about it. And while I really think everybody should know more about this, I sincerely wish that we will have the time to talk about something else than the Sweden Democrats, because I think, generally speaking, the media, both national and international, have been focusing too much on the Sweden Democrats. I think they are what in the literature is generally known as a media darling type of party, because they're sensationalist, because they deviate from the norm. They are introducing radical elements. They have kind of outrageous political statements, not necessarily from the main leader of the party, but from some of the party members or leaders at a local level. And that makes them very attractive in this clickbaity way. And in a sense, we're kind of now falling a little bit for this. But of course, we have to talk about them because they are the major winners, in the sense that they are the party that developed most or gained most votes compared to the 2014 election. So who are the Sweden Democrats? They are what I would call a welfare chauvinist party. I do not like the epithet populist for various reasons. We're not going to get into that right now, but I don't want to use the term populist. I don't want to use the term extreme right, because unfortunately there are parties who are truly extreme and to the right of the Sweden Democrats, active in Sweden right now, the newly formed Alternativet för Sverige, which is a very related cousin to the Alternative for Germany, which is probably more famous at this point. So I think the best way to describe them is as a party that has a welfare chauvinist agenda and neo-Nazi roots. It was found in 1988 out of these very, very neo-Nazi, very extreme organizations, civil society organizations. The party, though, has changed very much since those days. And I think the main responsible for this recast is the current party leader, Jimmy Åkesson, or Jimmy Åkesson, as we say it in Swedish, who became leader in 2005 and decided to take the party from the fringes into the mainstream. And this policy, which is similar to what other parties of the same nature have attempted to do, also probably in closest to us in Denmark, this policy of mainstreaming, of normalizing, has been very successful. So this is what we see today, a party that has become acceptable in the higher quarters of Swedish politics, and a party that has a more moderate agenda, at least on paper. And it's difficult to comment on every level, because some of the local party leaders, some even of the national party leaders, but not the main guy, so to say, are very radical still, and their neo-Nazi roots still show. In some other cases, this is not visible. So Jimmy Åkesson and several other main figures in the party are, in their discourse at least, relatively more moderate. At the same time, in the latest party debate that was taking place on the national television, the public broadcasting station, Jimmy Åkesson did, more or less spontaneously, or I don't know, planned, say something very, very radical, that immigrants are not Swedish and they don't belong here.
Mm. Okay, so I agree. We don't want to spend too much time talking about the Sweden Democrats, because even though they did get the largest share in the votes, they're probably going to be excluded from governing, right?
They didn't get the largest share of the votes. They got the highest increase percentage-wise in
the
vote.
And the biggest party by vote share was the Social Democrats, right?
The Social Democrats remain as they have been since the beginning of the 20th century, the most powerful party. And this is why they could still call this somehow a satisfactory result, even though they have gone down with about more than 2% from 2014.
I think it's interesting because Sweden is this multi-party system, right? They have tons of parties, but they've also been kind of consolidated into blocks, right? You have kind of a left block of parties and a right block of parties. So I was wondering if you could give a little kind of background into the Swedish electoral landscape and kind of what the results mean, because as I read it, and again, it's kind of fresh and I haven't totally digested it yet, you have the sort of left bloc with a lot of votes, the right bloc with a lot of votes, and then the Sweden Democrats are kind of forming a wedge in the middle. So how is that coalition going to work
out? Exactly. They are basically at 40%, 40.6 versus 40.3, even though these results are likely to change in light of the postal votes that are awaiting counting, as well as the Sweden abroad votes. We have about 150,000 to 200,000 votes that still are left to be counted. And this is very exciting. The difference between the two blocks, the left and the right, is only 30,000 votes. So it is almost certain that by Wednesday, we will have a different percentage and probably we will see a increase on the center right, because the Swedes who live abroad tend to support the Conservative Party more than the Social Democratic Party.
And last sort of media point on the Sweden Democrats, which is what the mainstream media and the international media have been making this about, is the sort of rise of populism, Euroscepticism, nationalism. What does this mean that the Sweden Democrats did increase their vote share? I mean, there's been talk about a possible Swexit. Maybe that's overblown. I mean, what do you think will come out of this election?
No Swexit. This is one clear message I have for the SMNP podcast listeners. No Swexit. I think there is no support for such a position. And not even the Sweden Democrats explicitly or consistently said that Sweden should get out, but they promised a similar referendum like the Brexit one. So they said that if they were to form a government, they promised to hold a Sweden membership referendum, copying the UK model. This is definitely not going to be on the agenda for as far as I can see. So no Swexit. But yeah, it's I don't think it's necessarily a rise of Euroscepticism. I think in party debates, the left-wing party that also had on its party manifesto the point of exiting the EU, they have played down that particular point. So I don't think that Euroscepticism is significantly on the rise. And looking at the opinion polls, European Union and Europe in general as a form of cultural attachment is more popular than 4 years ago.
We have a question from Nils Spierings, a colleague down in Nijmegen in the Netherlands. He agrees that the media pays too much attention to SD. He says one of the best newspaper website coverages that he's read so far is from Al Jazeera. Is it a coincidence that this is a non-Europe, non-US source?
I'm unfortunately unfamiliar with what Al Jazeera has been saying about the Swedish elections. I'll definitely check it out after this recording is over. But perhaps indeed it has to do with the desire of American and Western European news sources to relate the Swedish case to their national developments, to kind of bring it home and make it relevant for the national discussion. And since a kind of growth in Euroscepticism or this exit referenda have been the talk of the town in many places, maybe this is a reflection of this attempt of journalistic combination of foreign and national news. It also may be just something that we've been used to, almost as a normalization. This is something that we normally at this point talk about. But there are other things that I think are quite exciting about the Swedish election, and I'm looking forward to talking more about that.
Yes, I will just add, there's an interesting thing about Al Jazeera on this point, which is they're based out of Doha, Qatar. And there was some controversy in the Middle East, sort of Saudi Arabia putting pressure on Doha. So that might be because they're, I don't know, relatively an outlier in the Middle East. Maybe they are covering the election in a certain way. So let's talk about the winners, the Social Democrats and Prime Minister Stephen Löfven, who is sort of still in power, right?
The representatives of the center-right bloc asked for his resignation, but he decided to stay on and to manage the transition, which will happen probably in the next 2 weeks. We will know more about that. And the results on Wednesday will also give more ground to negotiations, simply. But again, I wouldn't necessarily call them winners. I mean, they are the largest party, but first of all, they have lost compared to 2014, and this is the worst result since 1908. I don't know if this says something. This is their worst electoral performance since 1908. So yeah, it is not necessarily a happy picture from the Social Democrat point of view. A lot of their voters went to the Sweden Democrats, something I think 11% of former Social Democrats went to SD, but a lot of their voters also went to their left, to the left party as well. So they have kind of been siphoned of votes on two edges, on two ends. And this is, of course, a problem. I think also we see this very poor result because of their very poor management of the refugee crisis of 2015. So this is perhaps a short-term punishment for the amount of confusion this government has generated. It was a very, very confusing time. To begin with, Sweden proclaimed itself an open door country, allowing more than 100,000 asylum seekers to arrive in Sweden. And then a couple of weeks, or not a couple, some weeks after, the government basically shut down the southern border with Denmark, effectively suspending the Schengen Agreement. So this kind of pendulum switch between very, very open and quite close confused a lot of the people that were supporting the government, and also generated a lot of uncertainty for the refugees, for the Swedes, and in the international community. So I think this is a sign of that criticism that traditional Social Democrat voters brought to their party.
Mm. And I want to stick on Stephen Levin in a second. But I want to ask you about the sort of social media campaigning side, the digital campaigning side, as this show is about social media and politics.
Exactly. This has not been covered by too many other news channels, so we could definitely make a scoop.
Yes, and I for some reason I follow the Social Democrats. I used to follow all the parties, and I think I follow Moderaterna, the sort of center right, and Social Democrats, the center left party. And I have a funny example of campaigning on that side. But let's start broad and talk about, you know, where is Sweden in terms of digital campaigning?
Sweden has not been an early adopter of this, also because of various national regulations. But this election has actually been seen as taking off social media campaigning from the party side. So now we're talking about the legitimate party paid, officially connected campaigns. And all parties have invested quite heavily in video material and promotional material, specifically through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And the most intensive campaign has been driven by the center party, Centerpartiet. And I don't know if one can see an association or not, but the center party has done its best election with 8.9% of the votes as we have them now in 30 years.
Hmm.
So they have seen a major, major improvement.
And what's their platform?
They are a little bit, as the name says, a center party. So they take some solidarity elements from the left. They are for a very relaxed policy in terms of immigration and asylum seeking. So they are interested in taking in more refugees and taking care of them. But they're also interested in environmental protection. They're the Green Party on the center right. Mm. And they're interested in this kind of more liberal entrepreneurship. So they are combining some elements of economic conservatism with some elements of welfare and solidarity values from the center left.
And I want to keep on going the digital campaigning route, but we've got to talk about environmental protection in the Swedish context, particularly with all of these wildfires, which has a little dash of European solidarity in there. Can you break that down?
Yeah, I was actually expecting that the environmental crisis of this summer would play more of a role, and maybe did play a role for the center party with their pro-environment message being heard louder this time. But because what happened, we had this summer the warmest summer in 260 years. I have all these records, like the first time ever, but it's true. It was the warmest summer since the weather reports have been grounded in Stockholm in the 1700s. And that gave rise to a very many wildfires, forest fires in the northern part of Sweden in particular. At some point, I think there were 52 simultaneous fires going on, which definitely could not be managed with Swedish resources alone. So Sweden got a lot of help from its neighbors, from its Scandinavian neighbors, but also put a call to the EU as such. And firefighters from Poland, most famously, but also from France and from Spain, arrived to help manage the fire. So that was definitely a show of solidarity, of a proof that the European Union does work in that sense when you need it most in emergency and catastrophe situations. And I think this is one of the reasons why this Swexit discussion never really bloomed too much, as far as I can tell.
Because, you know, I'm not in Sweden and I haven't been following the wildfires so closely. I mean, it kind of mimics what's going on in California, I think. But what I did notice from the digital campaigning side was a lot of effort by the European Commission on their Facebook channel to make videos saying, this is European solidarity in action when you have Italian fighter jets basically dropping bombs of water. There was an actual bomb that was dropped.
Yeah,
right?
That was the Swedes themselves. It was the Swedish Army, Swedish defense, that in order to control an absolutely gigantic fire, they basically bombed it with actual warlike bombs in order to suck the oxygen out. Basically, it was like turning the fire off. Of course, with a lot of damage to the ground as it really blew things up.
And so Sweden is this massive country. I mean, it's 9 million people, but by land mass, it's enormous. Did these wildfires actually, were they just burning kind of in the woods, or did they actually?
A majority of them did take place in the uninhabited forested areas in the northern part of northern Sweden, again, which is a third of the country, which is sparsely populated with a low population density. So as far as I know, there were no huge property damage in terms of humanly inhabitation, but the damage to the economy, and these forests were basically a fantastic resource, both for the environment and for the economy. Mm. And we're talking about billions of euros in costs of this particular catastrophe, yes.
So going back to digital campaigning, what we know, I know from the academic side, there was a study by Moe and Larson in 2014 where they were looking at Twitter and Facebook and comparing, I mean, they did more than this, but what I remember from the study is they looked at how many followers each party had. And what is interesting is that all of the parties that were in opposition in 2014 had the most followers. And I think the Feminist Initiative, a sort of small party with one seat in the European Parliament, had the most followers, which is kind of this a challenger effect where the opposition tends to have more social media followers and also tends to be more highly engaged on social media. So do you think that's changed? Did social media factor into this election?
This is very exciting too. I mean, there's so many aspects to it. First, let me comment on the Feminist Initiative that unfortunately doesn't seem to have made it big this time either. They have gained some seats in the local councils in different municipalities across the nation, but no presence in the national parliament for FE this time. They are the most digital savvy party, also because their electorate is very young and digital born and digital savvy as well. So something like 90% of the FE supporters have a social media account and actually use it, which is interesting in comparison to the Sweden Democrats. The Sweden Democrats, according to various studies done by a survey in particular, do not have a very active membership in terms of their social media habits. So people who tend to vote Sweden Democrats do not check their Facebook every day, do not have a Twitter account, do not have a Snapchat account, do not have an Instagram account. So this is the core of their electorate. At the same time, their social media presence is disproportionately large. So Sweden Democrats were number two in terms of Instagram followers and in top three in terms of Facebook followers. And again, I'm not entirely sure of the numbers. I don't want to give the wrong impression, but they're definitely among the most active users of social media in their campaigning, despite the fact that it is not to their supporters that they talk. And this is the interesting part. FE uses social media to reach out to their supporters. This is the way they organize themselves, this is the way they communicate internally and to the greater public. Whereas the Sweden Democrats, which are also very present on social media, use social media as an outreach-only tool. They do not talk to their voters through social media. Most of their messages are directed towards the media, the regular traditional media, towards other parties, and towards their the potential electorate, but not the ones that are already part of their core voter electorate. So I think it's very interesting to see this very strategic distinction. And I think the other parties are situating themselves in between these two extremes. I think the center party has tried to recruit more actively in the line of these persuasive campaigns of the Sweden Democrats. So the center party has tried to apply this method, and maybe it really worked. But so social media really played a role, but it's hard to say, as always, if there is an offline effect of this online campaign.
Yeah, and I think we know from our friend Jakob Svensson, who's a researcher over at Malmö University. He's done some research comparing the Swedish political parties on social media inside of elections, so during campaigning, and also outside. And what he finds, and I think what's interesting, because in the sort of academic field, there's not so much focus on platforms like YouTube, which is the second largest social media. It's mostly Facebook and Twitter, particularly Twitter. And what he finds is that actually the Sweden Democrats were most active on YouTube They have a podcast channel. So there might be, I'm speculating here, but there might be a difference in the mediums where maybe the Sweden Democrats talk to their supporters via YouTube, via podcasting, these kind of direct audio-visual type of mediums, whereas the more text, image-based medium like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, maybe that's where they go for that kind of larger talking to outside their supporters.
Yeah, I just found the numbers for Instagram, and according to numbers that were collected maybe a month ago or so, the Sweden Democrats are by far the most popular with 70,000 roughly supporters.
Really?
And the Feminist Initiative are basically half that, 35,000 behind them, and everyone else is trailing behind with the Christian Democrats with only 7,400 followership.
That's super interesting because I know I pulled this data about a year ago, and at that point, the Feminist Initiative had 29,000. They were by far the most, and the Sweden Democrats had 13,000. So they've increased from 13 to 70,000. I wonder, you know, is there any buying of likes or are people following them just because they're controversial? I mean, but that's a that is not the figures that were there a year ago.
No, definitely there's a huge change. And again, bringing in the bots into the social media discussion, there's a lot going on there. There's a lot going on. And it's, again, very early, and we don't have a lot of clear tests of this, but we know there has been an attempt to use social media bots in order to affect the election. And again, we have different research. One of them that I consulted recently was done by the Defense Research Institute, the National Swedish Defense Institute, that has tracked over a six-month period the Twitter activity for hashtags related to Swedish politics and the election. And looking at that discussion, they have seen a domination of, they identified bots, but again, it's not very clear how they identified it, so all the caveats apply. But they did identify a quite significant proportion of these automated accounts that supported the Nationalist Party. So of all the accounts they looked at, and it's about 7,000 such accounts, which is a lot for a small country like Sweden, where Twitter is not particularly popular. We are looking at 47% of all the messages that were emitted by these bots in support of the Sweden Democrats. And the next in line would be the Alternative for Sweden, which I mentioned before as to the right of the far right, so to say. And they got 29%.
Together over half.
By far. They're like two-thirds of the content of the social, of the Twitter bots was supportive of these nationalist, chauvinistic accounts. At the same time, the presence of people that support these two parties is real. So we cannot just say it's all bots. They're all bots. And who knows who programs these bots? We don't know that, actually, who's behind the bot. If you look at the genuine accounts that use the hashtags during the same time period, we have 28% of the accounts supporting the Sweden Democrats and 27% supporting the Alternative for Sweden. So even if we eliminate the bots, there's still a lot of real people or real accounts who are engaging themselves very, very clearly on the side of this far right.
Which we see in basically every election, whether it's the U.S., I mean, from our own research on Brexit and the U.K. elections on Twitter, on Facebook, it doesn't matter where you look, the right wing, particularly the sort of extreme part of the right wing, is just by far the most active. They go into other people's Facebook pages. They're trolling. They're disproportionately represented online, and that's something that we see in almost every context.
So I think this is something that can be explained partly because of the Swedish restrictive access to traditional media. I think the traditional media, newspapers, TV channels, radio channels have been very conservative, if you wish, in inviting the niche parties to the right to be part of the conversation. And only recently have the Sweden Democrats been given an equal amount of airtime on national radio and national television. So perhaps it's a natural escape route for parties that do not have the privileged access to traditional media to use social media and reach to their voters, potential voters, this way. So this may be a necessity or an alternative channel simply. Or there may be some other explanations, but definitely we see this very clearly at play. And again, we don't know in the Swedish case, if there would be like the Russian interference, there was always this kind of interesting effect. Do we see this? Do we see this as play? It's hard to tell. This report doesn't point in that direction.
And I want to ask you about that. Liz from the Transparent Referendum Initiative was asking about the YouTube study. I will post all of that in the show notes. By the way, if you want to hear more about TREF, you can go to episode 45 of this podcast. But there has been a study. I'll put this in the show notes as well. The name slips from memory, but it was in some type of military studies journal. It might have been the same institute that you were talking about before, the sort of Swedish defense. And they looked at Russian disinformation in Sweden on Facebook, I want to say around 2014, 2015. And they found that particularly Russia Today and Sputnik were very active in promoting news, fake news, but it's more complicated, which I'll get to in a second, on Facebook. Those accounts have since been shut down by Facebook. But what they found is that these accounts, Sputnik and RT, were promoting a lot of news mixed in with this type of like division sowing content. So they actually had a lot of clickbait, a lot of real news, and also they would interject in that sort of sowing division against the West, particularly NATO, because Sweden is very close to Russia. So I wanted to ask you about the Russian disinformation part, but you sort of precipitated the question. So we don't really know what's going on there.
It's very unclear. It's very unclear. I'm familiar with a study that comes from the well-established Comprop section at the Oxford University, and they have looked at misinformation and computational propaganda in the Swedish election right now. And again, the main takeaway, just to cite from their own report, is that most of the junk news that they have observed is homegrown, with 8 of the top 10 junk news sources being of Swedish origin. So that would kind of counter this particular theory of Russian interference. In other words, the Swedes don't need the Russians. They can do it very much on their own. And again, from the same study, which I think is pertaining to the same topic, we could see definitely that Swedes are not immune to the distribution of junk news, as to use the report's term. This is a very prevalent use. Despite their, at least in theory, high literacy and high habitual use of internet, or maybe despite of it, the social media users in Sweden are definitely sharing, helping these junk news to become more viral quite a lot. One for every 3 URLs shared is junk news.
And I want to ask you, because we've looked at this, we did a study on this, I don't know, 5 years ago by this point. But one of the things that's interesting about Sweden, and we think of social media, we think of Facebook, we think of Twitter, but online forums are also considered a social medium, right? Because you're posting. And there is a website, an online forum in Sweden called Flashback, flashback.org. I don't know how popular it is today. Maybe social media has cannibalized some of its market. But it's very similar to a Reddit or a 4chan, something along those lines. And I think has been sort of a breeding ground or discussion space for Sweden Democrat supporters. Do we know anything about Flashback?
And I don't think Flashback is as popular as it used to be. I think the newer meeting ground is called Avpixlat. But it's very similar in nature. And probably there's some other sites that I'm not particularly familiar with. So if you know something, just leave a comment on that. But generally, I think that environment is still there. And I think if you want to compare it, you would compare it to Reddit, just so people would get an idea what it is. It would be like a Swedish Reddit. And the discussions are very honest. The discussions are very critical. And most of the discussions tend to be in favor of the right chauvinist positions, indeed. And again, I think it's in part because, one, the traditional media does not welcome these opinions in the mainstream display. Two, a lot of the newspapers and TV channels and radio stations shut down their comments section. So you cannot go and leave a comment on Aftonbladet or DN. only on some sections, and very few articles give you as a user this option. So you, if you want to engage, if you want to comment, if you want to react, if you feel very strongly about an issue, there's not so many places where you can do that. And since social media platforms like Facebook and to some extent YouTube and to some extent Instagram allow you, do not allow you to be as anonymous as you'd be because you're embedded in your friend and relative and acquaintance networks, the best avenue to carry on these discussions is in these anonymous forums. So that's one potential explanation.
Mm. And going back to the kind of more mainstream social media, like Instagram, I just want to share a funny anecdote from the election that I was following. So the Prime Minister of Sweden is Stefan Löfven. And on Instagram, a sort of youth wing of the Social Democrats, or I don't know who's behind the account, but they started a Instagram. I don't know how many followers, but in the thousands, like pretty significant. They had a Instagram account called I'm Loving It. Mm-hmm. So Stephen Levin, loving it. And they would basically, you know, post stories using McDonald's sort of slogan of I'm loving it. I want to say, don't quote me on this, but I do think it was an actual concerted effort by the Social Democrats Youth Party, which is kind of funny, right? Like it's appealing to that younger voter demographic, which I think is worthy of note. I think Sweden is among the top three Snapchat countries in Europe. I mean, there's, and you know from being in Sweden, mm-hmm. Instagram, Snapchat, they are hugely adopted. So do you think those spaces are getting more political?
Definitely. We can see with these numbers that I just recently quoted, with the exception of one or two parties, most parties felt the need to be active on Instagram. But their messages, again, not a consistent analysis, but more anecdotal stories, they are not very political. They're more personal. They're more general ideas, pretty pictures, this kind of grassroots generated kind of unprofessional campaigns that are funny, but that raise the profile of the particular candidate or particular party. But in terms of commenting section or any kind of spread, again, Instagram doesn't allow you to share, like it doesn't have a share option. So we don't know how viral these contents can get. My sense is not super viral. But what I know for sure is that Instagram has been a great platform to advertise, to use paid advertisement to spread the designed, carefully crafted commercials from the political parties. And they have been watched millions of times because you can see that.
Yeah.
So definitely these have been used.
Yeah. It's a little bit, you know, they count it as a 3-second view, I think, on Instagram. But have you been following these parties? I mean, I'm wondering if there's a lot of advertisement on Instagram. We see that trend. We see about 90% of that traffic being on mobile devices. Are you noticing that there is the same content shared across platforms, or is it sort of customized?
Same. I definitely looked at this, again, not systematically, but enough so I can make a statement. In my observations, the videos that were circulated on Instagram are the same as the videos that were circulated on Facebook. And I haven't checked, unfortunately, I haven't thought about to look at the YouTube channels, but I'm pretty sure there wouldn't be much of a variation in terms of the content. So I think it's the same. Maybe like the actual format, like the 2x4 or 4x6 or whatnot, this is different, but the content is simply the same.
Yeah. And that's where it gets a bit tricky, because I think I checked the Sweden Democrats YouTube page a while ago. Some videos get no traction, some get a lot, but I think that has to do with when they're shared on Facebook. So the YouTube videos are basically just reappropriated to Facebook. And then so
the YouTube is a repository of all the films they want to put out there.
Yeah.
And also I wanted to bring up very briefly in this context, the idea of micro-targeting, which a lot of people talk about in the American context. This is probably not happening, to preempt any kind of comments from any curious listener, because one, there is a very strict data regulation happening and you do not want to overlap different registers. And two, because we have a multi-party system with a proportional representation. So trying to target with a specific message a category of people would basically imply if you are talking bad about another party, you would talk good not only about yourself, but also about many other parties that share your issue. Mm. Even if you talk about immigration, you think it's issue, ownership, clearly Student Democrats. But the conservatives, they also embrace this. And the Christian Democrats have also embraced almost a similar stance to the one embraced by the Sweden Democrats. So being tough on immigration and micro-targeting people who are very tough on immigration doesn't necessarily deliver the message just to one party, but it may deliver the message to three parties with whom you are competing. So micro-targeting doesn't really work as easily in a small country with 9 million people. I think it's much more difficult to segment it and in a multi-party system, proportional representation, electoral law. So no micro-targeting at this scale.
And just to plug our previous episode with Dr. Nick Ansett, he's been doing some research in the British case. And basically finds that micro-targeting doesn't seem to be as segmented and as sophisticated as we're sort of led to believe. And, you know, this whole idea of micro-targeting kind of exploded after the U.S. election, where the key point, I think this is super interesting, the key point is that in the U.S. you have to register to vote for a party in the primaries, and that makes the data for micro-targeting so good. When you don't have that and you have a proportional representation system where first past the post doesn't decide the election necessarily, then micro-targeting is kind of loses its luster.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And probably it's used as in every advertising, right? Like if you watch tennis, you don't see the same advertising as you watch football. Mm. But it's this very, generalizing categories that you're using, not this micro. The targeting exists, but not the micro.
So let me ask you another question about the impact of social media on election coverage, and particularly in terms of polls. So the sort of oft-cited cases of Donald Trump and Brexit, where the polls are wildly off. Was this the case in Sweden, or were the polls pretty spot on?
They covered a wide range. Again, with just using the Sweden Democrats, they've been the range of their potential win was between 16 to 24. So different polls have used these different margins to place them. And they are at a very low end of that spectrum. So most of the expectations based on these polls were at the higher end of the spectrum. Most people were speculating 2021. That would be like an average of these extremes. And obviously it turned out this way. And one of the reasons why this is happening, why is the difference in the other way around in these polls is because Swedish pollsters have been very careful to not repeat the error that they have done in the previous two elections, namely to underestimate the Sweden Democratic voters. Mm. Because it was this kind of stigma associated with saying, I want to vote Sweden Democrats. And they, in this poll, they say, no, we're going to weight it differently. So the results of the Sweden Democrats have been weighted differently so that to compensate for this potential reluctance to confess your political affiliation with ASD. But this hasn't been the case. So that's why they were overestimating the polls were overestimated compared to the actual results.
And what do you think? I mean, I'm thinking we saw a really interesting presentation at the American Political Science Association a few weeks ago that was comparing, it was by Pew Research, and they were looking at can social media, I think it was Twitter particularly they were looking at, I think they had Facebook as well, and they found that basically they could predict with about 90% accuracy, between 80 and 90%, that the social media data would kind of correlate with the polling data. I mean, what's your take on that? Do you think that social media can be used to predict elections?
Maybe in different countries. It doesn't seem that this is the case in Sweden. No. Again, as we just recently discussed, the presence of a certain segment of the political spectrum, this extreme right in particular, is disproportionate to the actual proportion of the population. Again, we have recently discussed why this is the case, but that is totally misleading. The demographics of the social media landscape are not necessarily reflecting the real life situation. Mm. And this has to do with the way social media is generally used. And again, we can put this in the larger picture. It has to do with trust in the traditional media. A lot of Swedes still go to traditional media channels to get their information and to engage with that. Sweden is a newspaper country. Declining numbers by absolutely certainty, but still a lot of people get their information through newspapers, their online version, but nevertheless, the traditional newspapers, watch public service television, and listen to public service radio. And these channels have quite a high degree of trust. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask something that you're interested in your research, but I'm just looking right now at the Politico Brussels Playbook newsletter, where Ryan Heath did some great coverage on this election. And his first sentence opening up this newsletter is polarized. That's Sweden in 2018, not merely between two parties, but three distinct visions of governing. Do you think Sweden is polarized? Did this election show that polarization has come to the welfare state?
This is a very good question and opens up a lot of potential comments. Thank you for asking. I think my first reaction would be it's more fragmentation than polarization. I think this is, apropos the main takeaways, this is another one of the takeaways besides this change, a radical change or departure from bloc politics. Political fragmentation and voter volatility are more of a trend than actual polarization, because what we see is that bigger parties, the conservatives and the social democrats, lose quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Smaller parties, almost all smaller parties except for the environmental party, the Green Party, all of them have gained, some more, some less, but all of them went up. And this is a similar trend that we see in the Netherlands. We saw a little bit of that in Germany and probably in some other cases that I'm not entirely familiar with at this point. But it's, I think, a European, at least, trend. And that's fragmentation. That's where the pool of the major parties is weak. And all these minor parties that have specific issues can have their own growing public. And that's fragmentation. That makes it more difficult occasionally to create coalitions, but that gives a better representation of the desires and ideas of the population. So it's a kind of, I don't want to deplore it. I just say this is what's happening. In terms of polarization, you see a lot of volatility of voters, which doesn't necessarily point towards polarization. You have voters that from one election cycle to the other have switched parties and camps completely. So from the left to the right, from the right to the extreme left, from the extreme left to the middle, people just voting all over the place. And for, again, a newer trend, 30% of the Swedes have split their ballot between the local, regional, and national elections, because most people don't talk about it, but there were three elections at the same time. So you could pick your local, your regional, and your national representatives. And people voted for one party locally, another party regionally, and yet another party in the Riksdag. And they could be from different political party groups. So you could vote left for the local, but right for the national. And that's accommodating. So I'm not sure that this is a sign of polarization, at least not in terms of political polarization. You could say something about effective polarization and this kind of distance taking, this kind of lack of, or actually this dislike of other parties, in particular when it comes to the dislike of Sweden Democrats by a lot of other parties, that Sweden Democrats have been seen as the untouchables, right? This could be a sign of some form of polarization, but I'm not entirely sure that we can talk about polarization yet. Mm.
Yeah, I'm just, again, thumbing through this newsletter, and it said 41% of voters switched parties between 2014 and 2018. That's crazy. But there's also something, I can't seem to find it right now, but that was also in this newsletter, talking about how Swedes can change their vote after they voted.
If you voted beforehand, like Swedes can vote in a, I think it's a 3-week period before the election day, by post or by physically taking yourself to some pre-election voting centers. And if you voted then, but you changed your mind in between your first vote and the election day, on the election day, you can recast your vote and you can change your mind. And I know several people who have done that for strategic purposes, because they looked at the opinion polls, apropos your question about the opinion polls, they looked at the opinion polls and they wanted to strengthen the alliance rather than the party themselves. So they took away some of their votes from the main party and gave it to a smaller party to make sure that that party would enter the parliament so they can form a coalition with the party that they for real wanted to support to begin with.
I got a question from our good friend Tom Moylan at the European Commission. He asks, have the results on immigrant votes come in yet? So the mobilization for Swedes overseas, Do you think that would be a...
No, they haven't come in yet. It's Wednesday. And they are absolutely decisive. There's no other way. Yes, it's decisive. Again, there are 30,000 or one mandate separating the left wing from the right wing bloc. So Swedes who live abroad will basically have the chance, the opportunity, or the responsibility to have switched the fate of the government. Most of the time, looking at the election data from 2014 and 2010, we see that the Swedes who live abroad tend to be more center-right, but also environmental-minded. So we can see, I mean, I'm making some very broad predictions, but probably we can see a growth for the Moderaterna, the conservatives, and for the center party, who basically inherited the environmental issue from the totally disgraced Miljöpartiet, the Greens. So if that happens, then the tipping point would move to the center right, and they would have probably one or two mandates over the Social Democratic-led bloc.
So going into my final two questions, it has to do with what does this mean for Sweden and what does this mean for Europe? Because of the European Parliament elections coming up in May of next year, the world's largest democratic exercise. So for Sweden, usually after an election, a government is formed by now. Right? It's
if it would be clear, we would know more, yes.
So now that we have this sort of 40% left, 40% right, 20% of Sweden Democrats, I know that's roughly, what does that mean for the coalition? I mean, when might we expect a Swedish government? Could we see a snap election? You know, what's kind of...
I don't think a new election is yet in the books. I think politicians are really going to give their best shot at making this work. But it's really difficult because mathematics don't help. The number of mandates, it will become clearer simply on Wednesday when we have the foreign votes in, or the Sweden abroad votes in. But regardless, it can be one, two, I don't know, radically say three mandates that switch places. It's still not going to get you a majority anywhere. So the question is, how will it work? And it's interesting to talk a little bit about how the Swedish decision-making happens. What Sweden has is something called negative parliamentarianism, which means that you don't need to have a majority to govern. This is in contrast to the US and in contrast to the UK. So you can be a minority government. What you really cannot afford to have is to have a majority against you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a permissive consensus. As long as they don't vote against you, you're fine pushing your politics. Just by abstaining, you can let a government run its policy. Mm. This is not the case now. You need the active support of parties from the opposite ideological end of the spectrum. So the way the votes are distributed right now mean that there needs to be some form of cross-ideological cooperation. And this is actually clearly the statement of Stefan Löfven, the prime minister. He, I think the most memorable quote from yesterday night was his statement that tonight we see the death of bloc party politics. Mm. And I think this is pretty much true. What kind of combinations do we have? We can have a grand coalition where you would have a conservative-led government together with the alliance parties and other three smaller parties in the government, but without the support of the Social Democrats, and instead with a social democratic passive support in the parliament. So voting on budget questions, voting on important issues on the side of the center right, which is the opposite of everything that they, in theory, stand for, right? So this is kind of what happens in Germany. We have in Germany right now one of these grand coalitions that crosses ideological divides in order to provide a functioning government for the country. But it has all sorts of negative consequences for the long term, one of which could be very well the strengthening of the extreme positions, because it's kind of a wishy-washy government. No radical changes can be done because both groups need to be on board. If we switch to the other side, if we say, okay, maybe we'll have a left-wing government led by the same prime minister or by the same party at least, with the cooperation of two smaller parties from the center-right bloc, how would that be? How would that match? How would they vote on issues that during the election campaign have become very clear as opposites not attracting, so to say. So this will basically lead to a lot of a deadlock, simply. And this has been the case also in Denmark for the past 10 years or so. Because of the very even distribution of votes across these options, the governments cannot really implement very radical changes. They must make very minute changes in one way or another because they need the support of the other side, and no side can compromise that much.
Mm. And so broadening out from Sweden to the EU, what does this election mean for the European Parliament elections coming up in about, 9 months or so?
It's in, May 2019. That is something like 9 months. I'm calculating desperately in my mind. I think definitely we can see the second order election symptom or syndrome creeping in. Is that a strong signal that the Sweden Democrats will perform very well during the upcoming EP elections? It could be so, in particular since there have been several attempts to coordinate the agendas of right-wing, extreme right-wing, or welfare chauvinist, or whatever you want to call them, parties across Europe. Solo Front National in France, together with the Bulgarian Ataka and many other parties, have tried to kind of reach a common ground, a common platform, and to basically take over as a group much of the European Parliament. Again, just for jokes, we can also say that Steve Bannon, the former Trump campaign advisor manager, has also attempted or is currently attempting to create a campaign platform to mobilize all the parties that are in support of this nationalistic, exclusivistic policy. So this could be one consequence for the EP elections.
And this is interesting, I think, and maybe Steve Bannon is exactly what they need, because we were watching this closely in 2014, the last European Parliament election. And while these sort of welfare chauvinist parties, anti-establishment parties, did have a lot of success at the national level, they could not consolidate into a bloc. You had a big split between Nigel Farage and UKIP in Britain and the Front National in France. So while you had these sort of anti-EU Eurosceptic parties winning in some cases in the national level, including in the UK, France, and Denmark, they could not consolidate into a European political party group. So perhaps they've taking a look at their playbook, maybe bringing in some strategists from the U.S. to try to actually exert some pressure at the level of the European Parliament.
It may be so that they realize together they're stronger. And again, as we ourselves have identified, there is a possibility to create a Eurosceptic common trend. But I think at the same time, all the other parties are aware of this. Mm. And we have also seen in Sweden that, again, the majority of the electorate has voted against this particular policy. So again, just to flip this entire media construction on its head, we are looking at more than 80% of the population who decided to not vote for the Sweden Democrats. I think this is, in a sense, the story to be told, that the Sweden Democrats have gained significantly, but that a majority of the population has not gone their way. And even if we look at parties that became a little bit cozier to the Sweden Democratic agenda, these parties are still not enough. In fact, the conservatives who adopted some of the Sweden Democrats' immigration points have been punished quite severely. They also registered a pretty significant loss.
Well, it's an interesting election. It's been fun to watch. I haven't watched it as closely as you have. But Dr. Ducek Segesten, thank you so much for taking the time out and sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Anna Maria Ducek Segesten, Senior Lecturer in European Studies and Vice Chair at the Center for European Studies at Lund University. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. Keep up with all the latest news regarding the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. And if you haven't already, you can rate and review us on whichever podcast platform you're listening on. It helps game those algorithms a bit. Thanks again for listening. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.